They want justice. They want answers.
What stands out to you about his personality?
What's the family want most of all?
Welcome back to another episode of Killer Genes. I'm Melissa. Today joining me is Dr. Robert Sapolsky. He is a professor, get this, of biology, neurology, neurosurgery at Stanford University. He's also an author of many books, including two New York Times bestsellers, with his latest, Determined, A Science of Life Without Free Will. So buckle up, because this is going to be a little mind-boggling. Lock in. Dr. Sapolsky, thank you for joining me on Killer Genes.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So I wanted to start off with, at what point, so you write about genetics, biology, environment, really impacting how someone comes to be before even conscious thought is even initiated. When did you figure out or find this notion that free will doesn't exist? When did this come to you, the evidence or the thought of it?
Well, I was actually 14 when I decided there was no free will whatsoever. And all that being a scientist has done since then is sort of give me facts to back up that conclusion. That's not to say that we are machines of our genes. We are not machines of our hormones. We are not machines of our childhood upbringing, but instead the interactions of all of them in there. But I've been deciding free will is a myth for an awful long time.
And how would you personally define what free will is?
Well, I think what resonates with people the most is where people really decide they're seeing free will when there isn't. You are given a choice. You can have coffee or tea. You can vote Republican or Democratic, whatever. You have a moment where you have to make a decision. You were consciously aware that you have to make the decision. You've got a pretty good guess that if you ask for tea, you're going to get tea. If you push the button for whichever party, it's going to register as such. And most of all, you know, you've got an alternative available to you. And for most people, conscious awareness, a pretty good sense that the outcome is what you're hoping for, and the knowledge that you're not being coerced, that's the beginning and end of it. Free will, that defines it right there. And that's as defined by the criminal justice system. Were you aware of what you were doing, and were you not coerced? And for me, that completely misses the point, because it's ignoring 99% of what's going on, which is, how did you become the person you are at that moment, who would choose tea over coffee, or would choose one political party over another? How did you arrive at that moment? And when you look at what turns us into who we are when we make those decisions, we get suckered in by the fact that the moment we make that decision, it just intuitively feels so much like we're agents of our free choice and free will, and we ignore the 99% of it as to what is it that sculpted us into making us who we are in those moments. And when you look at that, it's nothing but biology, over which we had no control, and its interactions with environment, over which we had no control.
So I want to dive into the criminal justice system, certainly, as this is a true crime podcast, and I've talked to, I honestly spend most of my weeks interviewing prosecutors, defense attorneys, jurors on why they made their decisions, convicted killers, and the loved ones of their victims. So I love this conversation. I first want people to understand really what you're honing in on, what makes up the lack of free will. Is it, you talk about prenatal environment, you know, because you maybe start there and then go into other factors, environmental, that play a role.
Yeah, well, one of the sound bites that's very relevant is environment does not begin at birth. You spend 9 months sharing a very intimate environment with your mother, her circulation, the hormone levels, the nutrient levels, sensory stuff going on, pathogens, and a whole universe of findings by now show things like, if your mother was starving during pregnancy, you're 20 times more likely than chance to have obesity and diabetes when you're 60 years old. If your mother was clinically depressed while she was pregnant and stopped being thereafter, significantly more likely to have depression or anxiety in adulthood. If you all sorts of prenatal environment, then there's postnatal environment, then there's adolescence, then there's the fact that your brain is still developing dramatically up to 25 years of age. And what is your brain doing in response to fetal, postnatal, pre-K, adolescent, etc. environment? It's responding filtered through what version of genes you have. The two interacting together. Fantastic example of this. This was a study that's going to be in textbooks for centuries, worked on by a guy named Avshalom Kaspi at Duke University. So there's this gene. It comes in two different flavors. It's got something to do with serotonin, a neurotransmitter in the brain. And what people knew from rat and monkey studies was if you had one version of that gene, one flavor, you were more likely to be aggressive. Oh, genetics of aggression. And people, of course, immediately sort of said, what about humans? And we've got two versions also. Oh my God, let's go and see if people with the scary version of it are more prone towards violence. And this was a massive study. They did thousands of subjects following them from birth into young adulthood. And back came the answer that yes, if you had the scary bad news version of that gene, you were significantly more likely by age 25 to have a history of antisocial violence.
What is the name of that gene?
If and only if that was coupled with a lot of childhood abuse. If you were not abused as a child, it made no difference which version of the gene you had. A gene called monoamine oxidase beta. It's got something to do with regulating levels of serotonin. In other words, whoa, what does having this gene version have to do with violence? Depends on your childhood environment. What does having an abusive childhood environment do to your risk of aggression? It depends. It depends on which version of that gene you have, an interaction between the two. So that being just one of the classic ways in which environment, starting in fetal life, but filtered thereafter, is going to be interacting as a function of the biology you bring to it.
Could you have the same, say, violent outcome if you have one without the other, or do they need to coexist together?
Well, what the study shows is each alone has a small predictor. The two together synergistically, more than just additively, increases the risk of, but that's just a subset of variables. There's other genes that have been identified that increase risk in an interaction with environment sort of way. And what should also be emphasized is another way in which environment is relevant here. Like, you have the scary gene version and you have it where you had an abusive adverse childhood, and in one cultural setting at age 25 you're more likely to be out mugging people violently. In another setting, you may be just a ruthless son of a bitch in how you play chess against someone. All a function of sort of what cultural pathways. And it's not by chance that you're much more likely to wind up being the latter type. If you grew up with socioeconomic advantage and familial stability and all that sort. So, like, some people take this gene-environment interaction into, like, very, very destructive behaviors. Others into, they become a ruthless CEO of a successful startup. So cultural context matters a ton as well.
I also love that you talk about that contrast in regards to testosterone, which I was surprised to learn. It doesn't accelerate aggressiveness, but simply amplifies what's already in you, like you just mentioned, for the negative and for the positive. You know, dispel the testosterone and then the dopamine levels and its impacts on human behavior.
Great. The myth of testosterone that everybody knows is, as you said, testosterone causes aggression. testosterone does not cause aggression. What testosterone does is it makes your brain more sensitive to environmental triggers of aggression. It ups the volume of your sensitivity. Classic demonstration, you take five male rhesus monkeys and put them together. They form a dominance hierarchy of numbers 1 through 5. Take number 3 and shoot them up with tons and tons of testosterone. Does he get involved in more fights now? Absolutely. Whoa, testosterone makes you aggressive. But then you look more closely. Ooh, is number 3 now challenging number 2 and number 1 for dominance? He doesn't go anywhere near them. What he's become is just a nightmare bully. What he's become is just a nightmare bully to numbers 4 and 5. Testosterone there is not creating new patterns of aggression. It's just upping the volume of, I can be a jerk to numbers 4 and 5. So testosterone doesn't cause aggression. It amplifies your sensitivity to environmental triggers. Then another layer of revisionism came in, which is even more interesting, which is testosterone makes you more sensitive to cues for aggression if and only if you're in a setting where being aggressive gets you social status. If you're in a setting where being generous gets you social status, testosterone boosts that. It boosts whatever you need to do to attain or hold on to status. And that produces this totally crazy finding, which is solid and replicated, which is you put somebody into playing an economic game where they get brownie points by making more generous offers, and you give them testosterone without them knowing it or controls, and they become more generous. What's that suggesting? Whatever gets you status in your world, that's what testosterone is increasing the sensitivity to the cues for that. And all you need to do is, I don't know, go to some fancy prep school where once a year they have their auction night for the supporters, and they show up there and they've got an auction of something or other and make sure everyone is drunk way too much. And all these alpha male guys are competing with each other as to who's the most alpha by how much money they're giving away to the school. No baboon could make sense of that. In a setting like that, that's what testosterone is doing. So if the problem is testosterone and aggression are going hand in hand, it's almost certainly because it's a social setting where you are rewarding aggression with status way more than you should be.
Do you believe in change, or is that an illusion? When it comes to, for example, someone who was raised in a violent surrounding, and maybe they saw something that didn't sit right with them and they made a complete 180. I mean, I've seen what I believe is a 180 change in my thought process and environment within myself and within others. Is that real, or is that predetermined?
It's both real and predetermined, and it gets to sort of the second great way in which people hit a wall when they're saying, oh my God, how can you say there's no free will? I just chose tea over coffee. There's free will. The second way is, look at this amazing example of this person who has risen above their circumstances, or the appalling example of this person born into utter privilege and they've squandered it all away. Look at what they've done with what they've been handed. And that's reflecting this completely false dichotomy between the attributes you were handed. You're tall, you got a good memory, you're tone deaf, you've inherited a lot of money, and what you do with it. The biological attributes that you get, ooh, that's biology. You had no control over that. But what do you do with it? Do you show tenacity? Do you show backbone? Do you show... That's made of magic dust. That's not made of biology. And that's where people go wrong, because self-control and self-discipline and long-term planning and resisting temptation is made of the same biology as is having a good memory, as is having perfect pitch, as in, it's just a different sort of biology, but it's just biological. And what that addresses is you look at someone who has risen above their circumstances. They had lousy luck in whatever the circumstances were. They had great luck that they just happened to turn out to have developed the sort of brain that's good at gratification postponement. So what does that bring us to? You look at someone who's done something amazing and risen above, someone who has squandered all of that. You're looking at the same sort of biology. What's the biology underlying that? The most interesting part of the brain, this area called the prefrontal cortex. We got more of it than any other species, most recently evolved. Critically, it doesn't fully mature until we're about 25 years old. What does the prefrontal cortex do? It makes you do the right thing, even if that's the hard thing to do. All those good tenacity, self-discipline, emotional regulation, impulse control sorts of things. So why do some of us have stronger prefrontal cortexes than others? Are we looking at like Calvinist backbone here? Are we looking at biology? We're looking at biology. Stress hormone levels when you were a fetus from your mother is influencing the rate at which your prefrontal cortex is developing. By age 5, the socioeconomic status of your mother is influencing how much this part of the brain has developed. And big surprise, it turns out if you're being raised in poverty, on the average, this part of the brain is not developing as fast as in luckier kids, and you're already not as good at self-control. You look at death row in this country, and depending on the study, 60 to 70% of the men on death row have a history of concussive head trauma that damages the prefrontal cortex. And when you look at someone like that, and they go and they murder a bunch of people, you are not seeing a rotten soul with remorse incapacity for empathy. You're seeing a broken machine. The prefrontal cortex got broken in that accident, and their brain simply doesn't regulate emotional impulses. So you look at all of those, and it's biology, parentheses, interacting with environment, everywhere you look. And that's where you get to the issue of change, where people have decided they're now seeing that free will has to be for real, because they say, oh my God, if there's no free will, that means nothing can ever change. Everything was preordained like 2 seconds after the Big Bang, so don't bother trying to change anything. It's already set in stone, and that's totally wrong. Because change obviously occurs enormously. There's like people who for a living take tattoos off of people because it turned out the love of your life wasn't really the love of your life, or it turned out that like the swastika you got put on is like not what you want now that you're an ex-white supremacist. People change, societies change, but the critical thing is we do not choose to change. That's where this myth of free will comes in. We are changed. We are changed by circumstance, and we are changed by circumstance as a function of who we turned out to be when we experienced that circumstance. And that's where change comes from.
So many questions. Okay, let's go back to, so I've interviewed many convicted killers, and two sides to that. I've interviewed, I did a series here on Crystal Howell, 17-year-old, that shot and killed her father while he was sleeping when she was 17 years old. I've interviewed an accused serial killer, many actually, and I first want to get into what's common. A lot of the convicted killers, regardless of age, they all say when it comes to the act that took the life, that it was like an impulse. I mean, it's just as if they all had the same playbook. The wording was precise. It was like an impulse. It was like an outer body experience. Is that prefrontal cortex? And then weave into others that I've spoken to that have zero remorse or empathy, and it's clear. I can lay out examples of it. They just regret being caught.
Yep. Well, that's tapping into one of the interesting things about sociopaths, psychopaths. I am not up on the subtle distinctions between the two, but a lot of people have studied what's up with the brains, what's up with the bodies of people like that. And one of the more consistent findings is people like that are blunted in their autonomic nervous system. What does that mean? They have a high threshold for pain. They have a high threshold for arousal. It takes a lot to get their heart beating faster, to get their blood pressure going up. What do you get to that? They don't feel pain much. And thus, big surprise, they have a lot of trouble feeling somebody else's pain. But in terms of the first attribute, the impulsivity, virtually by definition, if someone does something where they would describe it as, before I knew it, I had done that. If somebody forms a strong, like, judgmental opinion, and they say, I don't know why, I can't tell you why, but it's wrong. It's wrong when they do that. Those are the signs that you were bypassing the prefrontal cortex. It lost control in the case of, like, an impulsive killing. In the case of, like, people who have very strong political opinions, for example, and they can't tell you why it's wrong for people like that to do whatever, you were seeing the extent to which we feel our way to moral stances rather than think our way. And when 2 weeks later, they come back to you and say, oh, here's why it's wrong when they do that, they are not having reasoned their way to their stance. They're coming up with a post hoc rationalization to justify their emotional intuitions. And the prefrontal cortex had nothing to do with it, and it had nothing to do with that impulsive half second. Because in that half second, nobody is going to stop and think, ooh, did I see the state legislature just up the penalty for first-degree murder or something? They don't think about that because they don't think. The prefrontal cortex is completely offline. What's that about? How strong of one did life develop in you? Life, the circumstances you had no control over.
So that goes also to self-regulation. And I mean, self-control throughout life and why some people teeter over the edge and most of us don't. Is that one specific prefrontal cortex weakened state along with an environment? Because what's interesting is a lot of, I think you'll also see in historically in serial killers, a lot of them were affluent. They came from good, loving homes. And, you know, you want to think the Buffalo Bill scary character is the serial killer, but it's really in modern times not. Some have loving parents that turn out this way, and I don't know if it's the world is your oyster an arrogance that they were raised in to believe that they were unstoppable, they can have anything they want, associated with some social awkwardness. But is it all the same across the board? Or do those little things come into play?
That's where we get into the most interesting cases, where it's lots and lots and lots of little things. And you take a jury and you're having someone who's saying, oh, we don't need to make major changes in the criminal justice system, that biology, neurobiology, it's... Here's where the little things come in. You take someone who has a firm belief in the criminal justice system, and you're trying to say, you know, when you look at biology interacting with environment, etc., criminal justice system makes no sense whatsoever. And they say, no, it's actually accommodating biology. You look at someone like, who's the guy who shot at Reagan? You look at them and you say, look, he had paranoid schizophrenia. There was something biologically wrong with him, and the criminal justice system worked. The jury said he's not right. There's a broken machine there. Or you get somebody with, like, massive damage to their prefrontal cortex from a car accident when they were 10, and at least in a subset of juries, they're going to say, yeah, biology is relevant here. That's a mitigating circumstance. So, whoa, we still have the total rationale for retributive justice and all of that, but we can recognize the edge cases. And that's where you're getting into trouble. Because you take someone whose frontal cortex was destroyed in a huge, horrible accident when they were 10. That's a singular event. And you could see an arc made out of pig iron connecting that event with their violence. Makes sense. We can see biology came in as a huge factor there. Where people have trouble is looking at the other examples of people who were violent, or the other examples of people who were rude, or people who are ungenerous, or people who were kind, or whatever. And those are not coming from one singular event where you can see the arc of causality. It's coming from a billion different things, starting from when they were a one-cell fertilized egg thereafter. And the challenges there are, we don't understand like how most of those influences work, but we can see they're just like spider webs. They're thin, tiny little influences. What that third grade teacher said that time, versus a car accident that destroys this part of the brain, and you see exactly how it works out. So people have trouble seeing where these spider webs come from, because science is like only working through this stuff. But the much bigger challenge is to really truly believe you put all those spider webs together, and collectively they form an arc just as deterministic, made out of just as much pig iron. The car accident scenario is just much easier to appreciate. So when you get people defending sort of the rationale for the current criminal justice system, saying, and yes, we can accommodate biological, organic, involuntary, involutional control problems, all they're saying is we could recognize the easy cases where there's no free will, and it's too hard to recognize that it's exactly the same in all these other cases, but it's hard to believe that spider webs all put together form collectively something deterministic. And that's it for making sense of like 99% of us who turn out not to be serial killers, or turn out not to be Mother Teresa, or like all of it. I don't know what made Mother Teresa, what made her, but making sense of how most of us became who we are, it's not singular events. It's spider webs and filaments of causality and influence and proclivity and vulnerability to one setting but not another. Put all of them together and you got an arc of causality there. Criminal justice system is just riding on the easy cases and then congratulates itself for being supposedly attuned to modern science.
I believe deeply in the fact, the biology, that our brains aren't fully developed until the mid-20s. And I've advocated for juveniles who are sentenced, one in particular, the story I did on Crystal Howell, 30 to life, even though we brought in evidence that she was verbally and mentally and at times physically abused. But it's the small details that the justice system, depending on the state where you live, focuses on, such as, well, her father was shot when his eyes were closed. It should 100% factor in. But when you sit down and you try to weave this into, I mean, you've worked with defense attorneys and you've worked criminal cases, you know, what would be your argument to expand the punishment phase and be more lenient, especially to juveniles that are being sentenced 30 years to life? You know, how do you sway that when they're so ironclad on the details? You know, for example, the Crystal Howell case, 17 years old, he was shot with his eyes closed. She didn't call police right after. You know, all of those things are absolutely wrong. But how do you rationalize a justice system when they're not really built and constructed to have compassion and empathy, although they say they are? But in most states, it's the hardened fist. It's the iron fist, first and foremost, to set an example. You know, and then on the other side, it's the victim side and what was lost, right? So it's a hard balance. But it seems like the overall theory of your writing is just more empathy, more compassion on why things happen. But if you were that person sitting across a nation of DAs, what would you say to them? So compassion would come out in laws and change.
Well, if I was being the hypocritical hired gun that I was in these law cases. I was willing to say, okay, this system makes sense, and here's why this person is an edge case, and I'm going to try to convince the jury of that by teaching them what does early life adversity do to the frontal cortex so that in those 5 seconds where they had made a decision and you, the jury, would have been prudent and self-regulatory and they were not, here's why the system was broken to them, blah, blah, all of that. And what was very informative was that spectacularly unsuccessful at doing that. I've worked on 13 cases and we lost 11 out of the 13. You know, they nod their head as you're drawing diagrams of the brain, and then they go into the jury room and they look at pictures of the corpse and they come back with an actual conviction. What I would say to the DAs is a few years ago, sort of a friend colleague who's a professor at the law school invited me to give a lecture to the first year law students their first week there. And I titled something like, Why You Should Quit Law School Immediately. Of saying your system makes no sense whatsoever. Because if you really truly accept that there's no free will, blame and punishment never make any intellectual or moral sense. They can be used as instrumental tools in some circumstances, but be very wary. But there's no basis. Blame and punishment makes no sense. At the same time, praise and reward make no sense either. Telling somebody that they should feel like they have a better soul because they're good at doing kidney transplants and saving lives makes no sense either. And out of that, merging those two sides, comes the view that nobody is entitled to anything. Nobody has earned anything. Nobody is intrinsically entitled to have their needs considered more than average or less than average, because none of us had anything to do with how we turned out. And thinking that someone is a better-souled human and getting to cut to the front of the line makes no sense. And hating somebody for what they've done makes as little sense as hating a tornado. That's just who they turned out to be. And, you know, no surprise, as far as I know, nobody in there immediately quit law school or has ever since, because the system is predicated on some people wind up being treated better than average by life for reasons they had nothing to do with, and some people wind up being treated worse, and somehow we could construct a whole mythology of system justification of saying that actually makes sense because they did something to be entitled to their better or worse outcome. And when you really look at it, it makes no sense at all whatsoever. So throw out the whole criminal justice system. Okay, are you going to have murderers running around on the street? Of course not. You have to construct a society in which you're protecting people from dangerous individuals, but you can do that completely taking free will out of it. And we've done this over and over the centuries. 300 years ago, somebody had an epileptic seizure, and it was obvious what was up with them. They were in cahoots with Satan, and they were incredibly dangerous, and the obvious neurological intervention to do was to burn them at the stake. And then we figured out, oh, that's got nothing to do with it. It's a neurological disorder. Or 200 years ago, there was still a common view that any sort of illness was a sign of a soiled soul. That was like standard Western Christian thinking. And your kid gets a nose cold, and in some extreme version of it, that was like logical punishment for some thing or other they had done, or more frequently something you had done and thus cursed upon the next generations. And then we figured out, no, kids get nose colds. Ooh, no, we can't do anything about that. That's not their fault. Of course we do. Your kid has a nose cold, you keep them home from kindergarten because they have the rule. Please, if your child has a runny nose, don't keep them at home so that everybody else is safe from them. But you keep your kid at home, you constrain them, you quarantine them, but you don't take their toys away that day and yell at them that they have a bad soul because they're sneezing a lot. a quarantine model like that is one built around, yes, protect society from the people who are dangerous, constrain those people, don't constrain them an inch more that they are than what's needed, and don't moralize to them any more than you would moralize to a car whose brakes aren't working unless you can't drive it anymore. Equally challenging is, yes, protect society from, say, brain surgeons who are not competent, make sure they get motivated to do the proper training, but do that free of moralizing as well, that somebody is more deserving of having their needs considered in life because they turned out to have good finger dexterity and they were socioeconomically lucky and thus could like make it through a residency without freaking out. Yeah, these are like incredibly difficult to do, but we've done it over and over historically. Every time we have a moment where we say, oh, I had no idea biology had something to do with it, and we subtract out a completely, you know, corrosive, distortive sense of what causes what, the world becomes a better place. Like, in my lifetime, when I was a kid, like, if the kid sitting next to me in school was not learning how to read, I would have an interpretation which would be the same as the teacher and the parents and the guidance counselors, which is the kid was not very smart and they were lazy and unmotivated. And then, oh, neurobiology discovered you could have these like microstructural abnormalities in some part of the cortex. So then a subset of kids, they flip letters back and forth that both have rounded loops. You got one version of dyslexia. No, they're not lazy. There's something wrong with their cortical architecture. And not only does that make the world better because it begins to teach you how to teach kids with dyslexia how better to learn, you're not raising people with dyslexia to spend their whole life thinking that they're lazy. And like, you go to like dyslexic chat rooms or whatever, and there's people talking about, God, I got my dyslexia diagnosis last year at age 40. My God, I've spent 40 years of my life hating myself. Why am I so lazy? Why am I so... Like, it's freeing. It's freeing in all these cases. Every time we get moralistic blame replaced out of, oh, here's the nuts and bolts about how this person turned out to be who they are, it becomes a more humane society and the roof doesn't cave in. So we got to keep trying to do that.
You were just referring to what you write about in your book, Quarantine Justice, Truth and Reconciliation. Do you think we are biologically predetermined, everyone, to be compassionate and have empathy? And could this end up being an excuse for people to say, not my fault, had to do it?
Well, two answers to that. First, you know, how do we make sense of humans amid all the other species? We're just another ape, primate, mammal, vertebrate, whatever. One of the defining things, probably the most defining thing about human nature, is we are least constrained by our nature of any species out there. There are fewer inevitabilities of our behavior than any other species. Genetic determinism is less relevant to us than any other species, and that's how we wind up living in the Arctic and the Amazon and deserts and communist and capitalist societies and polygamist and monogamous cultures and all, because we are freer from biological determinism than any other biological determinism outside of the context of it interacting with what sort of environment, cultural values, ecosystems, all of that. So on that level, human nature, like, it's really human natures, and it's one that is inseparable from environment.
It's using the biological factor of no free will as an excuse. I think if people were to mentally switch, if it was even possible, I don't think it is in our, you know, what you talk about, a punishment pro society. And I do get that, interviewing a lot of family members who have lost their loved ones to violent, horrific crimes. I get wanting to see punishment, an eye for an eye. I get that mentality. But I also get forgiveness and understanding as well. But what about the society where if you attempt it, people take advantage, because everyone does, and they just say, it's not my fault. It's in me to do it. How could I stop it?
Well, if you really take all this to its logical conclusion, fault is a nonsensical term. There's no fault. There's no non-fault. It's just, what do we need to engineer to keep people safe from how you turned out? And do it in a way where we're not telling you you've got a lousy soul because you don't have a soul at all, and not doing it so that you're in shackles, but figure out the minimal way of, okay, so you can't come within 200 yards of a children's school ground, playground. You can't, versions of that. But the main thing, once again, is just looking historically. Like somebody with epilepsy 200 years ago had a seizure and Satan was acting out on them and you burned him at the stake. Today you get someone with no prior history of epilepsy, totally from out of nowhere. They have a grand mal seizure, which is usually a really bad sign of a brain tumor for them. They lose control of the car and they kill a beatific, beautiful 5-year-old child. And you don't get a crowd of peasants who beat the epileptic to death at that point. Everyone says, what incredibly crappy luck, how horrible that accident, in the literal sense of accident, occurred. Does that mean we can't protect society? No. All the states have laws as to what length of time you need to be seizure-free on medication before you can get your license back away. We have solved that problem. There's nobody who is like plowing into people and saying, not my fault, I had an epileptic seizure. What the courts are still doing is holding somebody responsible if they have epilepsy and they didn't take their medication that day. That's one step further of the absence of free will, and that'll take us another century to realize the biology of having a seizure is no more biological than the biology of excuses we come up with for being self-indulgent. But that aside, yeah, we've learned how to do that. People with pitchforks don't show up for the burning of the driver's licenses of people with epilepsy. We say that was just shitty biological luck that this tragic thing happened. And at least we've got some societal mechanisms for making it less likely to happen again with this person. But it's not their fault. That's how they turned out. Fault is an absurd statement in that context, that it turns out they've got like screwed up potassium channels in one part of their brain, and that's why you have a seizure. What does that have to do with fault? Nothing.
So you're leaning more towards rehabilitation, how to fix, how to aid what's broken biologically or what environment bred.
Yeah, absolutely. That said, we're lousy at it. I mean, even take something relatively simple, like, anxiety disorder. In terms of the underlying biology, that's like trivial compared to antisocial behavior or how empathy works. And we've got like some baby steps of some of the medications that could be used, and they don't work on a large percentage of people. And of the ones that they do, they're intolerable because of the side effects. Like, we're lousy at the, it's just like such primitive level of understanding that we have about any of this stuff. Half the facts that, like, I've cited here were unknown 25 years ago. Like, a quarter of the facts were unknown 10 years ago. So we're really bad at doing this stuff at this point. So maybe, like, what we have to be satisfied with a lot of the time is just get blame out of the picture, just get rewarding some people with a sense that they have better souls than other people out of the picture as well, and figure out how to run society most safely, most efficaciously, by taking, moralizing nonsense out of the picture. And in the meantime, do the engineering in a only somewhat pejorative sense of the word, do the engineering needed to make sure that out-of-control sociopaths are not causing damage and people who have the capacity to become really good brain surgeons become brain surgeons. But the scientific interventions, it's pathetic how bad we are at it, because this is all very new.
So I have to ask you this question, and I'm sure you've had thoughts of it, because universally it's just heavy-hearted, but it's obvious there's a huge uptick in mass shootings in the U.S., now an ongoing issue of sniper attacks, politically based. I've talked to a lot of prosecutors on this. You know, it's a concern with the way that we're headed. Most are young, what I would consider younger people, let's just say 30 and under. Many seem to be smart, come from a decent home. It seems that it's more environmental with this uptick of mass shootings. It's isolation, it's inner turmoil from the way they were bred and raised in their environment or lack thereof, support in some way. What are your thoughts on what we're seeing?
I think that's a really important observation, where biological attributes, no free will, get thrown into it, is some of these are kids who've wound up with some personality attribute or some appearance attribute or whatever, so that they're more likely to be mocked and tortured by the bullies throughout high school. Some of them have off-putting personalities. The kid who did Sandy Hook was so clearly just so damaged in terms of autism, socialization, and stuff. So, like, you get horrible biological bad luck of being a funny-looking kid, and you wind up in some brutal settings, and they will torture you to the point that you're like a future mass murderer. They wind up doing that where they're born into a Buddhist temple, and it's a very different whatever. So it's heavily environmental, but it's also you had the bad luck to have attributes which in that environment say, kick me, marginalize me, peripheralize me, torture me for that, so that in a subset of them, a certain type of revenge becomes sort of the thing. I can tell you, have a slightly different setting, and what people do with that, with their revenge, is they become like incredibly successful CEOs. And you get to watch them up close, and they are sociopathically vengeful at the world, and happen to be, or like how long your resume is going to be, and you're going to make people regret what they did to you in middle school by getting tenure at an Ivy League university, or like it's whatever pathways. So it's environmental stuff, but it's environment interacting with varying degrees of utterly random biological luck.
Is everyone redeemable to you?
I'm nowhere near that optimistic. We're biological machines, and some machines are broken, and in principle you can fix every machine, but some of those are going to be 1,000-year projects to figure out how to fix them. And all you do at that point is quarantine-ish intervention of both the negative and the positive moralizing. I don't know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, if you had told somebody that it would be possible to give somebody a pill, and in a significant subset of people with psychotic hallucinations of hearing voices, they would go away, they could be fixed in that way, that had been viewed as ludicrous, unimaginable. So who knows what the world will be in 25 years, but it wouldn't surprise me, you know, no matter how many advances we make, say, for example, in curing psychiatric diseases, there still is always going to be a psychiatric disease that's the leading cause of psychiatric disorders, and thus is going to be the leading cause of misery to the sufferer. No matter how many diseases we cure, there's always going to be a leading cause of death. There's a fractal feel to it, expanding to fill the space. So, no, we're not going to be able to cure everything or fix everyone.
So you agree the justice system is important, but you just want to see it altered, more of a fixable situation, a transformation place where people go, not necessarily this dungeon and lock away the key and throw it away until they wither and rot, you know, type of privatization that we see of prison systems.
Oh, well, that's obviously completely barbaric. If fault doesn't make any sense, if there's no such thing as fault, if there's no such thing as evil, if there's no such thing as intent and deservedness and justice or any, you know, all of that goes out the window. Even like nice things like retributive justice, which is like so heartwarming, and I get them to sit down and, you know, perpetrator and the victim, and they find common ground, and before it's over with, they're all hugging each other. That's predicated on free will, and that part of it is the person has to take responsibility for what they did to this victim or this victim's family or whatever. Even that is already built around myths of free will. It's just going to be, you know, it sounds horribly mechanical and heartless to say, we're just machines. We're biological machines. We're made of the same stuff as sea squids are. We're made of more building blocks than they are, so more emergently complicated, unexpected things happen, but we're just machines. And if you say, oh my God, that's so dehumanizing, that's a hell of a lot better than moralizing somebody into having a rotten soul. We're just machines. We're the only biological machines who could know that we are machines. We're the only ones who could learn something about where the buttons and levers are, and thus be able to recursively do things to learn something about yourself, and thus put yourself in the future in a circumstance that's going to pull out that same positive attribute. There's recursive loops that sea squids can't do, but we're biological machines. And, you know, for better or worse, because a world built on deciding that there's deservedness instead, all it does is generate inequality and making people feel like they're responsible for stuff they had nothing to do with.
I'm just curious, random question, if any neurological, biological studies have been done on twins. You know, I think contrast is very interesting in siblings, why one goes right and one goes left if they were raised somewhat similar, you know. And I wonder, would studying twins in that, or what would help understand with a lot of people, myself included, who was raised in a similar upbringing, a similar environment, but my brother went towards addiction and self-destruction and I went the opposite, and maybe I went the opposite because I saw him and he's older. But I wonder if studying twins, or what else you could study to figure out if something seemingly seems the same, how come it ended up so different?
Great. One of the greatest Rorschach tests is you tell people one of the like most definitive findings of this whole field of behavior genetics. Schizophrenia, for example, you take a random person with schizophrenia and you take another random person and you say, what are the odds that this person shares this trait with this one, that they also have schizophrenia? And it's like a 1% to 2% chance. That's the incidence of schizophrenia in societies. Now you take somebody who has an twin. The first person has schizophrenia. What's the likelihood that the second one does? 50% chance. It's like 50-fold more likely. So what do you conclude from that? Oh my God, genes are incredibly powerful. What do you conclude from that? Oh my God, genes have like nothing to do with it, because half the cases, they don't share the schizophrenia. all the most interesting findings in behavior genetics come out to 40 to 60% heritability. And depending on what biases you go into looking at that, that tells you, oh, genes are incredibly dominating, or it tells you, oh, environment is incredibly dominating. As one way to appreciate that, you know, why do you wind up with twins or siblings or similar environments, whatever, go to very different directions. There's this whole super trendy field of neurobiology called epigenetics, which is experience does not change your genes, does not change the sequence of your genes, but it changes the regulation of your genes. How readily you turn some of them on, turn them off. Epigenetics is like throwing switches, on-off switches in one direction or another, permanently or at least long-lasting. And how does all of that work? You take two identical twins at birth, and you look at the pattern of epigenetic markers that they already carry as a result of 9 months of experience, and they are already significantly different. Just sitting in the womb for 9 months, two identical twins have had experiences that are different enough that their epigenetic orchestration is already different right at birth. Oh my God, they're sitting in the same womb, two different blood vessels from mom that just by sheer random noise are going to have different levels of hormones and different levels of nutrients, and like already they are different individuals because of how environment interacts with the thing they have in common. So twins, it's one of the most contentious fields out there, where it's like built around, do you say, whoa, 50% predictability, that's amazing. Whoa, 50% lack of predictability, that's really unimpressive about genes. It's what your biases are with that.
It's mind-boggling, like I said at the beginning. Last question for you. If we have no free will, what's the human experience to you?
Oh, crap, I don't know. The most demoralizing feature of it, I mean, people can go through, oh, that's terrible, everyone will just run amok. No, that's not necessarily the case. Oh, that's terrible, people will decide they can't change. No, educate them about how change occurs, all of that. Oh my God, like we're just a temporary collection of atoms that we call me that are destined to dissipate at some point and go back to being like dissipated in this huge, empty, indifferent universe. Bummer, where do you find purpose from? I think that's where you refer to the philosophers and poets, and where neurobiologists are not of much use, because like it's the same. Why are we here? Where does purpose come from? What's the source of human goodness? I mean, we can eliminate, it's probably not God. It's probably how good of a prefrontal cortex you happen to turn out to have, coupled with some other uncontrollable things. But where you get moral imperatives out of and a sense of purpose, none of this stuff teaches you that. It just teaches you what kind of problem the philosophers and poets are facing when they are trying to find motivation out of that.
All right. Well, Dr. Sapolsky, determined a science of life without free will. I think this is one of those episodes like your book where you read it slowly to take it all in. You know, you just listen, you read it slowly, because it is mind-boggling. It's really profound. I really appreciate your knowledge and your wisdom and your time and everything that you do for society and making our minds open and expand. I feel like the underlying basis is really compassion, empathy, and understanding, which we so desperately need. We so desperately need that in today's society. So thank you so much. Any final thoughts?
Lest I come off as preachy and self-congratulatory, 99% of the time I can't function as if there's no free will. I get pissed off at people. I decide I'm wonderful because somebody compliments the color of my socks. And, you know, I've been thinking this way since I was 14, but I still have to think hard to remind myself, wait a second, whatever I think I'm coming up with as a judgment for the source of somebody's behavior, I'm probably wrong. So I try to do the work of that when it really matters. And the rest of the time, I should probably read the book, but it's not going to have much impact on me, I suspect.